Good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a dialogue that we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and our colleagues. Liz Graves and I are your co-hosts. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and talk the towns. And a reminder, we aren't taking any calls during this hour. We're recording this in advance. And Liz, I'll let you kind of introduce our topic and our wonderful guests.
Yes, thank you, Ron. So it's said that human brains are wired to notice and remember negative thoughts and experience so we can learn from them. That's the adaptive reason, and we call that negativity bias. But it's also important to be able to imagine and draw on good experiences and happy endings. So a new book from the Maine-based Literal Books publisher called Positivity Bias sets out to demonstrate that importance. So we're thrilled to be here today with Jillian Burns, who's the editor of Positivity Bias. The subtitle is Maine Writers Defiantly Happy Endings. It's an anthology of short stories. And joining us also are two other contributors to the anthology, Madison Ellingsworth and Robert Diamante. Jillian lives in Gardner, and she's an editor and also a contributor of her own work of fiction to this as well. Madison is a contributor to this anthology and a writer and ceramicist and lives in Portland. And Robert Diamante is a contributor and a writer and lives in Bangor. So we're really excited to be together. Thank you, everyone.
Thank
Robert's
you,
now an established friend of the show. So we're really excited to have you back, and thank you for helping put this together.
Thank you. All right.
So what we do often at the beginning of the show is go around and ask our guests to introduce yourselves, just sort of a background on your life and your work briefly, not yet focused on this project, partly so listeners can begin to associate your voice with your name, and we'll hear who's in our virtual room. So Jillian, let's start with you. What's your story?
Oh, thank you. Well, I grew up in the Air Force, moving all the time, but I've lived in Gardner for 24 years, doing various odd jobs in writing and editing and teaching. My novel about a public radio reporter with too much empathy came out in 2022, and that's how I got plugged into Literal Books and got to meet all these nice people.
What's the novel called? That's amazing.
Soft Features.
Okay. Awesome.
Starting off with a plug.
Going on the list.
Oh,
yes.
Here, okay.
That sounds great. Madison, often we'll refer to it called Maddie, so we'll do that too. But Madison is how you'll see her name in the book. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I'm similar. I'm a transplant here to Maine. I grew up in Philly, and then I moved here when I was 9. But I attended the University of Southern Maine. I studied English. And I've been publishing short stories for the last few years, so still very early on in my writing career, but really enjoying doing things like this. It's such a fun opportunity. So,
yeah. Do you have who? This is putting you on the spot, and you can think about it and come back if you want. But who are your favorite short story writers? Like, who's your inspiration?
Right now, I've been reading a lot of work by Emily Rinkema. I think is how you pronounce her name. She's been published in a lot of indie publications, like a lot of online literary journals, but she lives in Vermont, and a lot of her stories are very relatable and kind of eclectic. So they're super interesting, worth checking out.
Well, those two words definitely describe this book, so I love that. Thank you. Okay, Robert, tell us something about yourself.
Okay. I think most people that know me and know my history will remember me as a photographer, a professional photographer for many years. And I have always written kind of quietly and then sort of came out as a writer about 8 or 9 years ago. And ever since then, I've had short stories published and essays and so forth. It's been kind of a wonderful transition from professional photography to writing. And I've had like a 35-year career in the jewelry industry, actually. That's my sideline. That's how I make a living until writing starts to produce a living. But we'll see about that.
Yes, it's still worthwhile doing, even if it can't be the only thing. I'm told even Mary Oliver didn't make a living as a poet, well, and she's the best.
It's important to love what you do,
yeah,
for sure. So I do love what I do as a day job.
Good. Yeah. Okay, so we'll dive in. So I'll turn to Jillian to talk about the genesis of this project, Positivity Bias. And you mentioned that you have done some teaching too, and the scene that I'll ask you to read from the introduction is with a group of sixth graders. You describe in it that when Literal approached you with a list of main writers for a short story anthology, you were already thinking about this happy endings, positivity bias thing. So would you say a little bit, and then I'll have you read a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I've been speaking to a lot of friends who, you know, would come to me and I would come to them and say, have you read anything really good that won't rip my heart out? You know, it's the 2020s, tumultuous times. And to try to find something that's, you know, literary, you know, satisfyingly literary, you know, not too flimsy, something that tells you a truth and doesn't necessarily give you some uplift, but doesn't depress you too. I was hungry for that, and my friends wanted that. And it came up, well, this anecdote that begins the introduction, you know, happened just in the nick of time. We mm-hmm. were talking about the uses of literature. I say later on that I will never, you know, talk trash about sad endings, and, you know, tragedy matters and tragedy is real and we need that too. But if it's my project and I'm going to have this in my head for a year, I'm going to selfishly give myself what I want, which is stories that are guaranteed to end okay. You know, not necessarily rainbows and unicorns all over the place, but okay. Okay. With, you know, some hope and maybe a new beginning at the end.
Perfect. Yeah. Would you share that anecdote?
Sure.
And tell us, I guess, what context were you with these sixth graders as a classroom teacher or a workshop? Yeah. Or okay.
Yeah, I taught middle school locally for a few years. It was a lot of fun. Middle schoolers are fun. They're crazy and they're fun. That's great. Why do people read? My sixth graders left me hanging a while, my whiteboard marker poised. At last, the class wag got us started, because we have to for homework. Educational requirements, I duly recorded. True enough, what else? To travel to different places without, like, having to go anywhere in real life? Great. Imaginative travel. What else? To do all kinds of stuff in your mind without, you know, consequences, someone supplied. Absolutely, I affirmed. Vicarious adventure. I explained vicarious and made it our word of the week. If you have a book, people don't come up and bother you. Murmurs of agreement from multiple corners. Social defense. And romance? Suggested a girl with a precocious taste for adoration and heartbreak. I added it to the board. Either her answer shocked the room into silence or the class was out of ideas. All right, think back on a book you loved, I prompted, even as a little kid. A book you couldn't wait to read because it was just... what? Fun. Fun. Keep going. Maybe this is like the consequences thing, put in a young philosopher, but I was just thinking you can see how stuff will turn out, like a science experiment with sort of people, if that makes sense. Makes sense to me. Laboratory of human experience. Does this get at what you're thinking about? Kind of. It's more like you can start to picture things happening in real life if you already saw them happen in a book. Warnings, I wrote. Is that a fair summary? Silence. Does it have to be warnings? Asked the wag, suddenly serious. I felt something close to shame, and also like the thrill of stepping away from a cliff edge. No, I said, it doesn't have to be warnings. It can be visions of how things might actually turn out okay. I'm no bubbling spring of positivity, and most of the time that's fine by me. It ain't the optimist on board who packs the extra rations and the sail repair kit. But on some matters, climate collapse especially, I can auger so deep into the doomsday position it hurts. That's when I turn to my husband and dare him to haul me out, to convince me that the forces of enlightened creativity might prevail over hidebound stupidity in the nick of time. Recently, we went back and forth over multiple dog walks and hikes and unfinished dinners, until finally he changed my mind. Or if not my whole mind, then my approach to the problem. The clincher was this. Theoretically, there are plenty of scenarios in which enlightened creativity wins. But if there's wholesale cultural depression, a broad inability even to imagine an outcome worth wanting, then the party's over. To achieve the good outcomes, we need to be able to picture them. And picturing them might take regular practice. My sixth graders, I realized, were right on the money.
Awesome. Oh, that was even more fun with your voice. Thank you. What happened next? You had some writers, I imagine you added a few more, and you had a similar a conversation that started similarly with each of them. How did that go?
I had the list. I added a couple of names. I sent out a call for submissions and waited, and not a lot came in. And then I reread my call for submissions and realized I was really defensive about this. I suddenly had a crisis of confidence that maybe happy endings are, you know, not cool, not serious. They're not artistic. And, you know, I think I had even said in the call for submissions, you know, I'm not looking for escapism. I'm looking for things that engage with the moment. And embarrassingly, I sent out a PS and I said, you know what? I was defensive. Escapism is fine. Fun is fine. Give me swamp monsters and teenage detectives. Bring it on. You know, don't hold back. And then I got more stories in.
Yeah, I think that's not embarrassing. I think that's wonderful to be able to you know, iterate. And
yeah, if you call it iterating, that's a little better. This is my first time as an anthologist.
Hopefully not your last.
I hope not.
You did great.
Well, I'm going to move things along because the hour is going to just evaporate. I'll just remind listeners they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about the new collection of stories, Positivity Bias, by Literal Books in 2025. You've just heard from Jillian Burns, the editor and contributor. Maddie Ellingsworth is with us, and Robert Diamante. And I'm going to read a story, a portion of a story called Surrender, from Dave Patterson. And Dave is a writer here in Maine. And let me go into the story. Dave is author of a novel, Soon the Light Will Be Perfect, and a story collection called Euphoria. In this story that's published in Positivity Bias, the main character is Cinnamon, after Neil Young's song Cinnamon Girl. She follows a dream and Henry, an older friend to New York, with the promise of a lucrative gig in a classic venue. She comes to realize the dream is a bust and leaves Henry to make her way home with her upright bass. And here's from the story. I stare at the subway map on the wall of the tunnel and trace my way back to Chinatown with my fingertip. I fill my metro card with enough money to get me to the bus station. On the train, I lean my head against the side of the car and close my eyes. I'm not sure how long I slept on Martin's couch, but it couldn't have been very long. It's a Monday morning and the train car is packed with people going to work. With one hand, I hold my bass and the other, I grip the metal pole as the train bounces through the tunnel. I'm half awake, half asleep, and that's when I remember another thing my father told me. When he was first diagnosed with cancer, and he still looked like my father, full head of hair, pink skin, strong muscles, not yet atrophied from being bedridden. He told me that he'd always wanted to visit the site of John Lennon's death near Central Park. This was when he was still trying to convince me to take up playing the bass. We sat at the kitchen table. He drank coffee, ate buttered toast, just like he always did. "I just think that spot would be charged," he said. That was all he said. We never spoke of it again. I took up the bass, and he got sicker and sicker. And eventually, I could play the upright, and he died. I turn and see that I'm leaning against a metro map. The train rhythmically pushes and pulls the massive bodies around me while I search for Central Park. I stay on the train past Chinatown and get off in Midtown. Morning air is cool when I emerge onto the street from the subway tunnel. A woman in a business suit leans against a marble building, smoking a cigarette. I ask her if she knows how to get to the Dakota. "Two blocks," she says, pointing. The doorman of what must be the Dakota is young, more of a boy than a man. He stands with his hands behind his back. His blue-gray suit is crisp, starched. I walked up to him with my bass and ask, "Is this the Dakota?" He turns to me and says, "Yes, ma'am." "Is this where John Lennon was shot?" He looks around. "I'm not supposed to talk to anyone," he whispers, but he gives a slight nod. Then his eyes look straight ahead, and he stands at attention again. Inside the courtyard of the building, a woman and her son appear. The doorman walks to the street and hails a taxi. He opens the door for the woman and the boy and carefully shuts the door behind them. I wonder if doormen used to do that for John Lennon and his son. Delirious with the frantic energy of the trip, right there on the sidewalk, I remove my bass from its case. I hardly use my bow when I play with Henry and Eli, but I take it out now. I tune the instrument, and while I do, I watch the doorman watch me. I'm sure it's against the law to play music on the sidewalk outside a building housing people as rich as a beetle. But I close my eyes and start the slow burn of Amazing Grace. I pull the bow across the strings, causing low vibrations that I can feel at the bottoms of my feet. My shoulders and back are bent in the instrument, over the instrument in the posture of my father. I squeeze my eyes shut. I'm bowing through the medley when I hear the doorman insisting that I stop, but I dig harder into the notes with the bow. Finally, he's so close to me, I can feel his breath on the side of my face as he threatens to call the police. I hit the last note and bow it out real long. I open my eyes. A handful of people have stopped. "What are you doing?" the doorman asks. I look at him and I say, "Surrendering." Again, that's from a wonderful short story called Surrender by Dave Patterson. What are people's impressions of that wonderful example of a positivity bias? Jillian, why did you choose that particular story?
That actually was one of the first ones to come in that was unambiguously making the cut. I actually put it in first because it's kind of a straight ahead, realistic story told in a, you know, normal, non-confusing, you know, the reader doesn't have to adjust to get into it. And the ending is such a great ending for that character. And although I was at a reading with Dave and somebody said, "I don't think that's a happy ending at all." Mm. And, you know, it's sad. And there's all this, you know, she doesn't wind up with the boy that she followed there. And, you know, she's thinking about her dad who died and John Lennon who died. But to me, you know, this is a classic happy ending. That's a new beginning. She's declaring independence and she's finding her own joy and her own art.
Great. Great.
This is Liz. At the end of that story, I thought of something. When I was this character's age or a little younger, I thought I wanted to be a musician. And my teacher, it was a singer, my voice teacher, when I graduated from high school, wrote me this beautiful note and some very good advice. And in it, it said, don't worry too much about how you think things are going to be because they will always be different and better or worse than you could have imagined. That's what my teacher said. And it was excellent advice. And that's a story made me think of that happy endings are almost always a curveball. What Yeah, any other quick? Yeah,
and I think, oh, and I think even sad endings, you know, whatever, any great ending is going to be a curveball. It's got to be a surprise.
Maddie.
I think, yeah, happy endings also, or these stories that have positive endings don't necessarily have to have a positive beginning. There's a few other books or a few other stories in the book where they play with these really dark themes, and some of them end with death, and they don't have endings that leave you thinking necessarily like, well, that was really happy. As I think that's the place where people get tripped up, is positivity bias is not necessarily about a happy ending. It's about the right ending and the kind of ending that makes you feel really good about the story itself.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. And maybe while we have you, while you're don't mute, let's turn to both. You have two stories, Maddie, in the book, and they're both about animals. Mm-hmm. And one of them is about siblings, which was another thread that I found interesting through several stories. Siblings tend to be a source of the unexpected in mm-hmm. our lives. So yeah. Let's talk about that one. So we're going from the beginning of the book to the end, and we want to hear about your story, Pig's Sister. Tell us something about its creation.
Yeah, so a lot of my stories, not all of them, but a lot of them play with animal imagery or anthropomorphized animals. Because I think when you introduce an animal into a narrative, like with Pig's Sister, you take this, like, it's something very classic, right? The relationship between an older sibling and a younger sibling. But then when you introduce an animal into the story or change that dynamic a little bit with an animal, you're able to see the ways where we as people kind of place blame onto our relationships, or like older siblings will blame a younger sibling for changing their family dynamic. And as people will think, well, that's fine. But then when you put an animal, which cannot really be blamed for that, into the situation, you think, it really is very silly. So that was kind of the kernel where Pig Sister grew from.
Great. Okay. Would you share some of it with us? Sure. It's not. I wondered if we had time to do the whole thing, and I think we don't. So I suggested,
just a little section.
Yeah.
Sure. I went outside and sat on the button swing in the backyard. Dark clouds were gathering. The sky shared my mood. I pushed myself by kicking the trunk of the ash. As I swung through the air, I wished I could go somewhere else, somewhere I could be myself, without always feeling like the Pig Sister. I pushed off the ash. In this somewhere where things would be my things and I would never have to share them with the pig. When I was given new things, I would not have to think about the pig having them one day. I pushed off the ash. In this somewhere filled with wishes, my mother would love me more than she loved the pig. She would make me, not the pig, eggs in the morning. She would wake me up with a high sunshine and not with the sound of her tickling the pig in the bedroom next to mine. I pushed off the ash again and again. I must have pushed a million times before I heard my mother's singing coming back up the street. I unloaded the groceries while she and the pig sat on the living room couch. They scarfed up sugar cookies from the supermarket bakery. "Any for me?" I called over to them, heaving the final grocery bags onto the kitchen counter. I heard my mother's chewing pause. "We just split the last one," she called through her mouthful of crumbs. "I'm so sorry, sweetheart. I thought you didn't like this kind." She was right. I didn't like them, but I heaved a great sigh anyway. The rain started after the sunset. I brushed my teeth in the bathroom I share with the pig, and drops peppered me through the window screen. My mother and the pig stayed up late watching Casablanca. I was in bed sulking when my mother brought the pig into my room. It was wearing a different onesie. This one was baby blue and had several balloons and purple thread on its chest. My mother plopped the pig into my bed, then told us that it was time to go to sleep. She pulled the covers up and smoothed them. "Good night, my sweet babies," she said as she turned the light off. "I love you." The door clicked shut, and the pig and I were left in quiet darkness. The rain tinged off the roof like a softly played triangle. I could hear the pig snuffling next to me, already asleep. I stared at the ceiling, feeling sorry for myself. Suddenly, a crack of lightning tracked across the sky, lighting up the room. At the same time, thunder ripped through our musical quiet. The pig and I both squeaked with surprise. I recovered, but the pig did not understand what was going on. It let out shrill oinks and paced around my bed. "It's okay," I muttered to the pig. "It's just a storm." But the pig continued pacing. I felt its hooves digging around in the blankets. I was about to call my mother, but first I reached my hand out to cover the pig. As our skins touched, he bumbled over to me. He shoved his head into the crook of my arm and curled up like a cat. The soft texture of his onesie calmed me, just as wearing it had calmed me when I was tiny. "It's okay," I assured the pig again. "It's okay." I decided not to call my mother. I laid my other arm across the pig and felt his heart begin to slow. He snuffled wetly. I dragged the blanket across us, tucking us both in. I warmed up fast under the layers, but it was nice to cocoon in warmth, listen to the tinkling outside, and feel another heart beating against mine. When the thunder boomed again, I rubbed the pig's velvety ears and held him tightly. I felt my heart open up like a locket, and I welcomed the pig inside of it. As I drifted off, I wished for a new somewhere, somewhere the pig and I could ride the button swing together.
Oh, awesome. Pig is a fun word to say. It's got, there's actually this and some of Robert's, there's some beautiful music in the words themselves, which is fun to read out loud. Mm-hmm. Jillian or Robert, any reflections or questions about this story?
I do. Madison, I loved both of your pieces. I really did. What are your inspirations? I mean, you talked a little bit about, you know, enjoying writing about animals and anthropomorphism and so forth. But like, where did you get this sort of absurdist structure? Like, where does it come from?
That's a good question. I guess I like the idea of having kind of a typical some element of the story that's kind of what you would expect. Like in my other story, we start out with, oh, it's just a couple and they're living their life and the reader can kind of settle in. And then you twist it on them and you say, well, now there's a worm and he's a very central character to this story. And I think with Flash, like shorter Flash, like Pig Sister is, you don't necessarily have the opportunity to start out with that level of stability and then build into something more complicated. But I really like the idea of it's not shocking the reader, because I think that that would maybe undermine what you're trying to accomplish with the story, but giving them something where they have to adjust to the world and then just kind of accept it. So like trying to present this sibling dynamic that everybody is, or not everybody, but most people are familiar with, and then saying, but actually it's a pig. And then the reader just has to say, well, I want to keep reading the story, so I guess I will accept that it is a pig.
Jillian, briefly, anything to add? What do you like about this story?
Oh, I was so thrilled when I came in my inbox. You know, the character is so pure and so honest with us. Mm. I completely believe the pig. And I am an older sister. I was 8 and a half when my baby sister came home. And I kind of thought she was, you know, an animal. That metaphor made real worked for me. And I loved having it last, because, you know, the first story ends with somebody declaring independence. And this story ends with somebody coming back to the bosom of family and having love and returning.
She didn't want to get rid of the pig sister after all. Yeah, I love that. I mean, I'm sure there would continue to be moments when she wants to get rid of the pig sister, but overall, awesome. Well, we will remind listeners that you're listening to WRU Community Radio. This is Talk of the Towns. We're talking today with the editor and a couple of contributors to a brilliant new short story anthology from Literal Books right here in Maine. It's called Positivity Bias, Maine Writers Defiantly Happy Endings. So the editor is Jillian Burns, and the contributors who are with us in our virtual studio today are also Madison Ellingsworth and Robert Diamante. So we'll turn next to Robert. I will not take too much time talking about how much I love this next story, Robert. Waiting for the Rapture is about the fine art of striking up conversation when you're alone at a bar. And I will say briefly that... Well, actually, a callback to the bit of the introduction that Jillian read, that as a sixth grader pointed out, if you have a book, people don't come up and bother you. So one of the things about making friends at a bar is don't have your nose in a book, as this character knew not to, or your phone. And when I moved to Maine, I was 26, I had been carefully tutored by a then boyfriend or recent ex-boyfriend about how to make friends at a bar if you're traveling or in a new place. So I was a student of exactly this type of conversation, and it's certainly how I made some of my first friends in Maine. I didn't have a conversation quite this interesting, though, so we'll turn it over to you to, give us any background about the story and share some.
The background of the story is that it is structured over an incident that really happened.
I wondered.
You know, it starts off kind of as a joke. A man walks into a bar, sits down, and makes an offhand comment to the waitress. And I was at a trade show in Atlanta, and it happened. Now, the rest of it is made up or embellished. So I'm not going to call it creative nonfiction or anything like that. It's truly fiction. But the kernel of the story is definitely built around one of my sarcastic offhand comments, and the brilliant waitress really rose to it. So I'll start off by reading a little bit about how he sort of finds the bar, and then we'll go into the dialogue. I'll just start reading. The bistro was a low-light affair situated inside an old brick bungalow. He entered into what had once been the foyer, where he was greeted by a young hostess. Per his request, she led him down a short central hallway, turned right to pass through the cozy dining area where several small tables and into the bar, which had once been a parlor. He recognized the shelves of bottles and glasses in the front window lit up pink from the sign outside. The atmosphere was as inviting as it had appeared from across the street. Four tall stools stood empty against the wooden bar, two more closest to the interior wall, were occupied by a couple. He pulled off his jacket, hung it on a chair, leaving a space between him and them, then settled in. The barman placed a menu in front of him. "Can I get you a drink, my friend?" "Gin gimlet up." He heard the tired, graveled edge of his own voice and smoothed it over by adding, "Cool to the taste, but warm inside." He smiled. "Please." The barman smiled back and nodded, then proceeded to make a show of it. He spun the bottles in his palms before pouring each ingredient into the metal shaker, replaced the cover and waggled it back and forth above his head so the ice rattled like a castanet, strained the frothing liquid into a chilled coupe, then added a stiff wedge of lime to the edge before sliding it over without losing a drop. "Impressive," the man said, although he suspected it would only be a middling cocktail, watered down for having been shaken so vigorously in the ice. Still, he nodded with approval after leaning over and taking a sip to appease the eager young barman. He scanned the menu and ordered what would be comforting, and the barman hurried off. Carefully, he raised the brimming glass to his lips and drew another sip. Not so poorly executed after all, he decided. As he powered down his phone and slid it into his jacket pocket, he thought how good it was to have the night to settle in before the next few days of business. They would be rough. He lifted his glass again and took another, deeper pull. Third time is the charm. The sudden settling in his body felt akin to a car's shift into lower gear. He closed his eyes and sighed. "Are you waiting for something?" He opened his eyes. A waitress was leaned over on the other side of the bar, so only her dark hair and eyes were visible. Either he hadn't noticed her before, or she had slipped in when he closed his eyes. "The rapture," he said. The sound of crunching ice had been coming from beneath the bar. It stopped. She was either annoyed or perplexed. He couldn't tell. He guessed she was trying to decide if he was a religious zealot or just being glib. She straightened and set an ice-filled glass on the bar, filled it with something clear and sparkling. The ice clinked as it settled against the angled interior of the tumbler, rising bubbles captured and carried, the rose-colored light filtering in through the window behind her. The waitress tipped her head sideways and frowned. "Are you really?" To him, it had been an offhand comment. He wasn't even sure why he'd said it. "No, I should have said I'm waiting for a Caesar or some butter for my bread." She nodded down at the bar. "But you don't have any bread." "Well, that's true." Do you want some bread? He shook his head. No, not really. But you want a Caesar, right? Yes, I just ordered one, with extra anchovies, he added, smiling. I heard. She lifted the glass to her lips and sipped, then set the glass back on the bar. The rapture, she repeated. Why did you say that? He shrugged. I guess it's because I'm in the South. Where are you from? Up north? She turned her head and looked at him sideways. That makes a difference? We don't have the rapture up north. Not like in the South. She narrowed her eyes. I can't tell if you're being serious. He raised his eyebrows, shrugged, and took another sip of his drink. I am a very serious person.
All right. And we'll just have to encourage listeners to grab a copy of the book to find out what happens next, because that's just the beginning. That's very, speaking of satisfying, is a word that Jillian used in the introduction, and it's a very satisfying story. What does anyone else want to jump in? Let's stay with Robert. Yeah.
I just had something to say. I have two stories in here, and Far, Far Away is, we're not even going to go down that road, but there was something at the very end of that story that for me sort of maybe quantifies or qualifies what a happy ending is. And the old, without going into the structure of the book or the characters, one of the characters says to the other character who doesn't get his happy ending, he says, you know, some people, because the character says, I wanted a happy ending. And the guy says, you know, some people get a bow and other people just get a tangled knot. But you know, you're dealt what you're, essentially what he was saying was you're dealt what you're dealt with. And it's not a matter of being happy or not happy. You get what you need to untangle in life. And it doesn't have to necessarily be negative.
Yeah, so I'm so glad you brought that up. Thank you. I had marked it too. The response is some people get a pretty bow, others get a knot to untangle. Yeah. So the invitation's right in there that what will be satisfying is, in your case, is untangling this knot, and then you will have what you need. Yeah, for sure.
And I felt like so many of the stories in this book had this sort of emotional entanglement with the characters that wasn't directly straight up happy. They were emotional. They invited into like an emotional space or an interior space, and ultimately led you to something that was more than, and that's what I really appreciated.
Yeah.
Jillian, maybe you could comment about your selection of the stories relating to Robert's comment there.
Oh, sure. I definitely wanted, I was lucky to have received a pretty good variety in genre and mood and setting. And also a great variety of kinds of happy endings. You know, sometimes the guy gets the girl and sometimes, you know, he doesn't, and that's okay. There's an ending in here that is only a happy ending in fiction. It would not be a happy ending in real life. And so, yeah, the selections, they were easy to make. I had to say no to a lot of stories that were wonderful stories, but didn't really have happy endings. And I spoke with those writers and I said, you know, if you did this and this and this and this and added this thing here, you could make it a happy ending if you wanted to. And nobody wanted to. And I was disappointed, but I completely respect that. So the ones who made it just jumped out of my inbox. It was very easy.
Great. Mm-hmm. Any other reactions to Robert's stories or reading?
I was just going to ask about Robert's story. I feel like the thing that I love about this story and then also about Not So Far, Far Away was how funny both of the stories are. They have like this very lighthearted element where it's almost like the narrator is self-aware, like the narrator of this story, and then the prince in the other story, that the life that they're living is totally fictional and just it's been constructed so they can kind of move through the world. Like he says in the story, like, I'm a very serious person. And clearly it's not true. And I guess what I was wondering is, like, is that a thread through all of your work? Is this level of kind of like lighthearted, like, and yet at the same, it's like lighthearted movement through the world, but it's a very serious world, and in a way it's a very dark world.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a complex conversation, and maybe we should go out for coffee sometime, Madison, and have a conversation about writing. I would love that, actually, because I'm a fan of your work too. I do like humor and wry humor, and there's the subtlety. I won't say irony, but I do like being funny. But as much I really like melancholic works, and I'm going to bring it back to the book and actually point to a specific short story by Kaylee Borden O'Brien, her To Dust, which she created such an amazing interior space. And that's an example of work that I love and I love to inhabit, even though I'm funny. And yes, the humor is a thread that runs through pretty much all my work. But I love to crawl into the spaces that writers create where it's a much more contemplative and interior. And she just sort of cracks you open with this story and provides this space for these two sisters. It's about two sisters who are coming together in the Great Plains, dusty Great Plains, to bury their mother. But the ending is just so beautiful that she's, and if you follow the narrative, she's just slowly cracking you open to get to that place at the very end where they're holding hands and they're sleeping next to her mother's grave. I mean, it was just so exquisite. That's a happy ending that just doesn't follow the form of, and they lived happily ever after. Mm. And I really appreciated that about that book.
Thank you, Robert. And you've kind of teed up the next section of our program, in which we'll ask each of you for some comments on other writers in the book. But reminding listeners, they're tuned to Talk of the Towns on WERU Community Radio. We're talking about the new book, Positivity Bias, Maine Writers' Defiantly Happy Endings by Literal Books in 2025. We have the editor and a contributor to that book, Jillian Burns of Gardner. Maddie Ellingsworth is with us. She's a contributor, a writer, and a ceramicist, and she lives in Portland. And Robert Diamante is a contributor, writer, jeweler as well, and he lives in Bangor. But let's ask each of you, perhaps starting with Maddie, is there another story that you particularly want to call out so listeners to WERU might say, oh, I want to get that book?
Sure. Yeah, I was going to talk about Lynn Seifert's story. It's called Let Fly My Tears. Mm-hmm. And she is a writer and a poet, and a playwright and a screenwriter. And I read recently that she's getting into writing more short stories. So I was just going to read a little excerpt from this, just a few sentences. But I love this story. It is so funny. And I think I was really drawn to it because it once again deals with kind of like a sibling dynamic with a much younger sibling. But it's just every sentence is packed with like this very powerful language that just makes you laugh. But so the few sentences are: Don is a freshman. He should be a sophomore, but he missed a ton of school due to mononucleosis, the kissing disease. He has a stigma attached to him, but I don't care, so did Jesus Christ. It's a relief to be in love with him. It's a relief to be in love with a normal person. Last year, I was in love with Alan Smith, who lost an index finger in shop. When he drove us around, he held my hand, which at first recoiled in horror, but later, no big deal, like holding hands with an alien. It was what it was.
Yeah.
And I think that section, it just, the whole story encapsulates what it's like to be a middle schooler, but just that little section, the logic of thinking, I don't care, so did Jesus Christ, is so, it has that same element that all these stories have where they're dark and yet they're so positive. They fill you with something.
Great. Great.
Yeah, it's a great connection to what Robert mentioned. To Dust, is that what it's called? When he reminded me of that, then I turned to Let Fly My Tears, because it's similar in that way, that the release, the happy ending, is this kid ends up crying on the couch with her baby sister in her arms, even though the baby sister is not an unmixed blessing in her case. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Jillian, do you have another story that you'd like to call out to folks?
Oh, sure. Well, I can't stop thinking about Jerry Boyle's story, Make Me an Angel. Jerry Boyle, he's a very successful mystery writer. He's written us lots and lots of mysteries, a longtime newspaper man. And his story is very hard-boiled. This is a biker grandpa who's his whole life is a series of screw-ups and disasters and bad decisions. And the best possible thing happens for him. And the tension is just exquisite. You know, how is he going to screw this up too? You know, will this also screw up? And the ending is this transcendently beautiful ending. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's only a happy ending in fiction, as far as we know. Got to get the book to read the story. But, you know, it has prose like, you know, Lenny, who fought golden gloves at 135 pounds, could have laid the boy right out, but he didn't, being his dad. It's this, you know, always flipping back and forth. He's, you know, in and out of prison, but he has a tame raccoon who lives with him in his trailer. And he reads Thoreau, which he stole from the library. great story.
Yeah, that one made me think of the Beans of Mexico, Maine. Things are really hard for this family and this character. And, oof.
Yeah, but the ending made me feel like $1 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Robert, I can see because we're recording this on Zoom and we have the benefit of the camera, but you're looking in the book. Do you have any other stories that you'd like to highlight as we begin?
Well, I just wanted to – can I read a little bit of Kaylee's story?
Sure,
some of her writing, just because you can tell I'm a fan. And I will say that I read one of her short stories in a magazine. She had won the Commonweal Award, and I read her short story, and then I read her bio, and I said, oh, this woman is in Maine. And I reached out to Literal Books and said, when you have an anthology, you need to dial up this woman. She's a very good writer. And I think it was passed on, must have been passed on to Jillian.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
That's so when I saw, I don't know if you knew that, but I was such a fan of her work beforehand. So there is just one passage that I'd really like to read. And just to set it up, she's in the Great Plains and she's gone back to her small town to bury her mother. There was a fire off over on the horizon, invisible save for its glow, and the low clouds were tinged with ashes of roses. It was almost enough light to see by as we shoveled the same dirt we dug that morning from the ground into the back of the Isuzu. Jean had brought a lantern anyway. My blisters reopened, but I was past caring. Jean wordlessly handed me the bottle of Bombay Sapphire she'd grabbed from the back wall of the end. It was full. We needed it emptied and filled with our mother's ashes by noon for the service. I took a pull. So did she, even though Jean never drank. I could just continue, but the space that she creates is just really lovely, and I really like that.
It's beautiful. I want to call out the two stories by Art Dingley, the other author who has two works in this collection, and they're very different. Decade is one of the longer stories in the book, and it's definitely eccentric, chewy. it's odd what happens and how it's told. So it's a vacation in Mexico for folks who live in Maine, and maybe that's all I'll say about it. And I was stunned by the other one that's called Redemption. And it's a really mental illness is a difficult thing to write about. And in this story, he takes the narrator is an unhoused person, I assumed in Portland, who has... is dealing with some psychosis and his redemption. It's a play on words with redeeming cans and bottles. His he gets prescribed some antipsychotics and they start to work. And there is the best description I've ever seen of healing from psychosis, which is a difficult thing to describe. It was really remarkable.
Yeah, that story is amazing. And that it is so short makes it almost an injection. You know, it almost is medicine all by itself. It's so potent.
Yeah, I guess there are paragraph breaks, but not many. And it looks like one big chunk on the page, and it's only a few pages. Yeah, it's really well done.
Yeah. Well, Art's a doctor, was a doctor and a lawyer, and now a writer. So I guess he'll be an astronaut next. I don't know.
We don't have a lot of
something.
Go ahead, Liz.
We don't have, just very quickly. I know we don't have much time left. I also noticed after the fact that one of the stories is published posthumously, if I have that right.
The one by Nick Bushell. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, Liz.
Yeah. So that was a very cool, WRU has a connection that a friend, somebody who was well known in our community passed away young, and his record collection was donated to WRU. And it was just beautiful tribute and a thing that he would have loved. And I sort of feel that way about this story. Like, what a cool thing that to connect with this person who's not around in that way.
I was going to just ask very briefly, if you have advice for other short story writers in terms of how to continue their craft. Again, very briefly, because we don't have a lot of time, but Jillian, can we start with you as an editor and a contributor? What small piece of advice might you give to writers?
Read a lot of short stories, pick an author you love, read everything, and reread. I'm a big believer in rereading. You take new things in with each pass.
Great. Maddie, what advice might you have?
I would say it's important to continue writing, even if you don't think that the work is good. You should just keep writing it. And then also, I've lost my train of thought.
That's all right. You'll come back to it. And please interrupt. And Robert, any thoughts about writers who were starting out, perhaps, or midway in their career, but they haven't published anything? What advice might you give writers of short stories?
I'll pick up where Maddie's train of thought left off. Write every day. And even emphasizing Jillian's point, read and write. Just don't be discouraged for, every 25 rejections, you might get one publication. And it's not even really about that. It's the act of creating and making, just like any other art form.
Oh, I have another one. Can I throw it in?
Yes, please, Jillian.
People say, never give up, never quit. You're going to quit. Quit, give up, and then start again.
And then unquit, yes.
Start again.
Great. It occurs to me that if somebody is really new to the scene, they might not know where to look for calls for submissions. How does one know where to look?
Yeah. The Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance
is
a great organization. It's based in Portland. They have a big fat website, and you can look through things. And if you join, there are meetups and calls for submissions and workshops and all kinds of great resources. MWPA.
Beautiful. Okay. We'll add that to the, where I have a bunch of great links in the podcast version of this show that'll be on the WRU website, including literal books and in each of your author websites. So we'll add that too. Great.
And Maddie, go ahead.
I remember my train of thought. I was just going to say, I think it's very daunting for people who are starting out. They think that a short story has to be about something really huge. And nobody has to get pregnant in your story or die or have cancer or anything. It can just be about something that you've experienced, and it can be about those things. But sometimes the best short stories are about just daily life. So,
Great. Liz, I'll let you ask the last question as we move into the conclusion of our show.
Okay, good. Well, I'll take a little bit of a different, normally a standard lightning round to end the show. one of the ways Jillian talks about happy endings and thinking about positivity bias in the introduction, she uses this phrase, enlightened creativity. And what do you think about why imagination and creativity is important? Like, what do you want? What do you want our listeners to take home about that? And maybe we'll start with Jillian quickly.
Quickly. I think it's the precursor to anything good happening. You know, if it isn't just going to happen serendipitously, then it has to be the product of imagination.
Has to be imagined. Great.
Maddie,
yeah.
Yeah, adding on to that, I think without imagination, without creativity, your life would just be the same again and again and again, doing the same thing always. It's imagining what's possible that allows you to write and then allows you to live your fullest life.
Yeah, and if it weren't for fiction, we wouldn't even have a way to talk about that. I was going to say it would be Groundhog Day, but that took imagination to create too. So here we are. Robert.
I just think creativity is a great engine that moves us forward.
Great. Great. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks to all of you. And I'll mention your names in just a minute. But thank you again. We've come to the end of an hour. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our programs can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for other topics, please email us news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Balnain House Island music recording. Thanks so much for our guest in the studio, Jillian Burns, as editor and contributor to the book we talked about, Positivity Bias, Maine Writer's Defiantly Happy Endings by Literal Books in 2025, along with Maddie Ellingsworth, also a contributor, a writer, and Robert Diamante, second time guest on Talk of the Towns. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to underwriters. Thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program and to College of the Atlantic for production help. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and 2 hours of jazz on Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.